Welcome to BOA Audio, Red Pill Junkie. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, Mr. Vinel, all I can say right now is about damn time. Jesus, what does a Mexican blogger have to do to be invited on Vinel of America?
Ladies and gentlemen,
ladies and gentlemen, Vinel of America Audio, with your host, Tim Vinel.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio. Finally, we are back live, because over the last 6 weeks or so, we've had no borders as well, traveling to Ireland, to talk to Peter Costello, going all the way down to Australia to talk to David Phoebe, heading to Japan to talk to Brent Swanser, and then last week on the show talking to Carl DeMarco in China. And tonight here, for the fifth episode in a row and concluding our international expedition, we go all the way down to Mexico City, Mexico, for a very special edition of the program. Our guest tonight is long overdue on this program, quite frankly, folks. I'm a huge fan of his work. And I've seen him online for years, and we've crossed paths quite a few times. And since we've been putting this episode together, it seems like we've emailed each other close to 1,000 times. So he's very prolific online. He's quite the online presence. And he is, as I describe in the blurb here for the program, an astute onlooker of the esoteric and one of the more perceptive pundits in the paranormal field. He is, of course, the man they call Red Pill Junkie. He has written for a real plethora of prominent websites, some real big websites, Daily Grail, Mysterious Universe, particularly those two websites. And he's been a presence online for quite some time and has sort of a origin story similar to myself, as he sort of started out as a fan and then became a content provider, content maker, pontificator. So I'm looking forward to talking to him about all this good stuff. And like I said, he's long overdue to appear on the program. So welcome to BOA Audio, Red Pill Junkie. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, Mr. Vinel, all I can say right now is about damn time. Jesus, what does a Mexican blogger have to do to be invited on Vinel of America?
The truth of the story is that we should tell folks, I reached out to you last April, not this past April, last April, to try and get a hold of Brent Swanser. And I'm like, I'm going to get you on the show too, Red Pill Junkie. Don't worry about that. But how can I get a hold of this Brent Swanser character? And we can lay this at the feet of Brent, I think. I think it's fair to say. And my own obsessive compulsive disorder, where it was like, I can't, once I sort of set the table that way, I was like, well, if I have Red Pill Junkie on before I have Brent Swanser on, I'm going to jinx this whole thing. It's not going to work out. Somehow I'm not going to be able to get a hold of Brent Swanser. So once we got Brent on the show, I dug up the original email to thank you, and I'm like, well, now it can all come together finally, you know? So I can put the last piece of the puzzle in. So
yeah, you remember that. Yeah, you're going to come here eventually. But first, who's this Brent Swanser? How can I get a hold of him?
Well, hey man, you're the man with all the answers. That's why you're Red Pill Junkie. That's, you know, I knew who to turn to.
Seriously, man, now this is a real honor for me. You know, I've been a fan of Vinel of America almost as long as I've been involved in the Fortean paranormal blogosphere. You know, mm-hmm. Vinel of America is without a question one of the most important Fortean and esoteric podcasts
on
the web
man.
Right now.
Thank you.
And yours is one of the few podcasts that I've actually listened more than once. You know, some of my favorite podcast episodes ever are part of the extensive Vinyl of America catalog, which is a veritable treasure trove of information. So, you know, I mean, really excited to finally be here. You know, it's a real pleasure.
Well, man, you know, the pleasure is equally mine. I really do. I'm a huge fan, and I was listening to your episode with Greg Bishop, and I was struck by how you sort of had, like I said, the same kind of origin story that I did. And you know, you're one of the good guys, RPJ. I'll tell you, you're one of the good guys. That's why I'm happy to have you on the show. I'm a lot more discerning about who I have on the program in my later years here as I grow older and wiser. So.
I'm more cynical.
Exactly. We'll get into that. Let's start off with the bio, the background. I'm sure there are people who are listening right now who, you know, that wouldn't make any sense, I guess. If they listen to Banal of America, I presume they sort of surf the paranormal waves online, but maybe they don't. Maybe they don't. So tell people, you know, who is Red Pill Junkie, and explain sort of why the non de plume, if you will. If that's
who
even the right word.
Junkie? Well, yeah. I haven't the foggiest idea. Well, to be honest, I really can't remember what kind of circumstances, you know, triggered me to come up with the name, you know, because I remember I was starting to using it even before I became a member of the Daily Grail, and after that, one of Greg Taylor, who is the owner and an editor of the Daily Grail, you know, one of his collaborators and news administrators, and after that bloggers. I suppose the reason why I chose the moniker was because by the time I went to watch the Matrix movie, which was had a huge influence on me, as people would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was already a big fan of Carlos Castañeda. I don't know if you have ever read one of his books.
I haven't read the books, but we've talked about it sort of in passing on the show with Adam Gorightly. So yeah, I'm familiar sort of with the whole story, but I have not dug into it myself.
Yeah, well, back in the day, you know, he was one of the biggest figures in the counterculture movement. You know, he practically kick-started it along with Tim Leary, you know, and all those guys, you know.
Yeah.
And then he became even was highlighted on the Time magazine at one time. But then, you know, it came all kind of crashing down with a lot of people who started to question the veracity of his story. You know, and then the whole thing starts to devolve into, you know, kind of like a cultish-like movement. And then the guy died of cancer, you know, which was kind of not exactly the way a true sorcerer or brujo, as he was claiming to be, you know, should have ended his life. But then, you know, and my own opinion about it is that even if the whole thing is completely a figment of his imagination, people should read the books because they are filled with a lot of very insightful, very meaningful philosophical lessons they can apply to their lives, you know, like the
right.
idea of like living your life with like a warrior, right? You know, thinking like a warrior, how, you know, thinking that you are a being that is about to die eventually, you know, about how being aware of your own mortality is one of the things that give meaning and power to your actions and all those things. But anyway, getting back to the Matrix, when I first saw the movie, the whole thing, you know, kind of like made sense because I felt that the movie was kind of like the cinematographic metaphor of Carlos Castañeda's philosophy, you know. Neo was like Carlos, you know, this neophyte, you know, this sorcerer's apprentice who finds Morpheus, who is like Don Juan, this Jackie Brujo, you know, who takes the apprentice under his wing and teaches him to be aware of this bigger reality, you know, outside our normal sense of perception. But instead of using the red pill, like in the Matrix movie, Carlos Castaneda uses what he calls power plants, you know, the psychedelic substances like peyote, another kind of psychedelic plants. And from that, the whole thing progresses, you know, and that's when I realized that the whole thing is a very Gnostic-like story, you know, and yeah. I guess it resonated with me so heavily because I guess I am a very Gnostic-like individual myself.
Okay. But tell me, sort of do the bio background, though. I mean, we kind of understand where the origin of the name came from, but, you know, what about the origin of the man? You know, how did all this come together? What drove your interest in this? How long have you been interested in sort of the strange and unusual, and what led you to go sort of like walk down a path that I did, which was sort of where you went from like a fan to a producer. You know, there's only a few of us. I guess we all sort of start as fans, but at the same time, it's like you and I were kind of like very public fans of stuff, and then all of a sudden it was like I'm gonna make stuff too. So that's awesome because that's what I did. So, you know, how did all this kind of happen and originally what sparked the interest in all this?
I really can't say what sparked the interest because as far as I can see, I've been interested in these sort of things, well, all of my life. You know, like I said in one video interview I made last year when I was at the Paradigm Symposium with my friends Micah Hanks and all those guys, I'm a child of the 80s, right? You know, mm-hmm. So I was born right along when Hollywood was producing films like Star Wars, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So obviously, you know, that kind of pop culture had a huge influence in me.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, I guess there was something else, you know, I think that people in my family have also been interested in these kind of things, even before I was born. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I used to go to the houses of some of my relatives, some of my uncles or some of my great uncles, you know, and I would find in their libraries, you know, books about the Loch Ness Monster, of UFOs, and obviously those were the books that I would inevitably pick up whenever I went to visit them, you know, and I will just reread them over and over again, you know, and I guess what I'm trying to say, you know, is the interest has always been present in my life.
You know, yeah.
I can't really remember a time when I was not interested in things like UFOs and cryptids and ghosts and all the like.
Okay. And then you just kind of started posting comments on stuff and ended up writing on your own, writing at various sites and stuff. So it's pretty, you know, it's a remarkable journey in a way.
Yeah, I due to a rather serendipitous set of circumstances, I ended up finding the Daily Grail back in 2007, I believe, and I became a member. And I started to, you know, just hang out there, you know. There was a very lively and dynamic community of free-thinking people who were sharing all sorts of ideas and, even more importantly so, you know, doing it in a very civil and cordial manner, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I guess, Greg Taylor, who, as I said, you know, is the owner of the site, ended up contacting me via email, you know, and asking me whether I was interested in becoming even more involved with the site, not instead of just being a member, you know, so
right.
Becoming one of his news admins, you know. And obviously my first reaction was, no way, you know, I was terrified, you know. I felt I wasn't cut up for the job, you know, that my English was still, you know, wasn't perfect enough for it. You know, but the guy said, you know, well, think about it, you know, let me know, you know, if there's no rush. So I thought about it, you know, I think we were going through the end of the year holidays. I was with my family in a beach somewhere, you know, and after that I said, you know, why not? You know, let's do it, you know. And truly, in hindsight, this was one of the best decisions of my life, you know, becoming a member of the Daily Grail, and from that, like you said, slowly progressing and becoming more and more and more involved on the paranormal scene until I became, you know, a blogger, you know, writing things of my own instead of just comments, you know. I've been one of the most interesting things that ever have happened to me, you know. So far, it's been a great ride.
Nice, yeah. Well, I can appreciate it because it's, you know, I have a similar background, I always sort of say that this is the best way to get into all this, because it's like, I, like you, you know, I sort of spent years absorbing all this stuff before I said anything. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you need to sit at the table and listen for a while before you can really talk. And I think, you know, to turn on my cynical side, it's like there's a lot of people that just sort of barge in and sit down at the table and have something to say. And it's like, where did you come from, man? And do you know A, B, and C or what? And nine times out of 10, they don't. So it's kind of like, geez, like what the hell? But, you know, that's the paranormal for you. Anyone can come and sit at the table.
Another thing that I'm sure that you realized along the way when you were just trying to get your toes wet on the field, so to speak, is that whenever you gather the courage to reach out for one of the big guys in the scene, you know, people like Stanton Friedman or Lauren Coleman, you find out that those guys, you know, are more than willing to reply back, you know, to us, you know, the naive, the whippersnappers, you know, the young guns, you know, because they themselves were the young guns once in a while, you know, and they reached out to Ivan Sanderson and all those other guys who were the big guys before them, right? So it's gonna interesting progression, you know. People will be amazed to know that if you manage to go and actually write a letter to someone like Stanton Friedman or some of those big names, they will reply you back. You know, they are that awesome, you know, in a very mentor-like kind of way.
Yeah. Both those guys are great. They're serious, mentors, I guess you'd say, of this program for sure.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I kind of promised you when we were setting up the interview, I wouldn't focus too much on sort of the Mexican Fortiana realm, but I did find it interesting. I was looking through one of your old pieces, and you say that you talk about the Mexican UFO wave of the early 90s and this eclipse event that sort of, you said your interest in all this went into overdrive. So I guess just sort of take me back, you know. Because we are sort of carrying on this theme of the international programs over the last few weeks. So I guess take me back, because we've never really talked about it on the show, to this 1990s UFO wave in Mexico. Because obviously I've heard about it. I remember it. I know about the, you know, the eclipse event. I've heard about it. But I've never really heard about it from somebody who was down there during the whole thing. And I guess you didn't see the actual thing.
The story of my life.
Tell us what happened there. But I guess just sort of, you know, paint a picture. Bring us back to that era when you know, most of the audience, almost all the audience, certainly wasn't able to experience it as you had.
Okay. So, 1991, I was just finishing high school, you know, just getting ready to go to college, right? And like you said, you know, it's kind of like, cliche to say, but it was really a different world back then. You know, we really didn't have anything like the internet, we didn't have cell phones, and more importantly than that, camcorders were just beginning to erupt in the market. You know, affordable enough video camcorders that were just portable enough so people will start to record, I don't know, events like their weddings or their graduation proms or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? So there was this eclipse, total eclipse that was going to happen in the great part of the Mexican territory, just in the center and the lower areas of the Mexican territory on July 11th, 1991, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very important event because it was going to last quite a while, and I think almost more than 6 minutes, which in terms of in astronomical terms, it really is a big deal, right?
Right.
So because you know total eclipses are not that rare, but you know eclipses that last that long are indeed you know just one in a century or something like that. So there was this going to happen, and like I wrote in that particular piece, I had decided to go on something of a road trip with some of my school friends. You know, an excuse to go out, you know, and have fun on your own. But then when I got back and started to read the news, I realized that some people were claiming that they had seen a UFO right during the moment when there was the total eclipse of the sun, you know. And sure enough, on the Mexican television, there started to appear these videos taken by a few witnesses, and not all of them were recorded on Mexico City. I have to point out some, I think, were recorded in the city of Puebla, which is not that far, but it's not exactly right here. So one can assume that there were more than one object which were hovering above these highly populated centers, you know, right at the moment when people were going to look up on the sky.
Right.
You know, so one could really make the argument that these objects were doing this in a very deliberate fashion. You know, they were meant, they wanted to be seen.
Right, right.
Right? So after that, things started to explode in the terms of UFO sightings, and riding the wave was a young television journalist by the name of Jaime Maussan, who by that time he was already making a name for himself with his involvement with ufology, right?
Right.
But using the Mexican UFO wave, he really harnessed that energy, that momentum, you know, and he started to collect all sorts of videos that people were sending to his way, you know, and he was presenting those in a late night TV talk show by the name of Usted Que Opina, and What Do You Think, which was hosted by a guy by the name of Nino Canoon. And these programs were extremely popular, you know. I mean, there was this time when I think one of those programs lasted almost more than 11 hours, you know. It was like a record in Mexican television, if not worldwide, you know. And just talking about UFOs.
That's crazy.
You know, that was the kind of hunger and interest that was among the public, especially people my age, you know, the teenagers and the like, were really having this crave to know more about the phenomenon. We really thought back in those days that the wave was a signal of that maybe, you know, the UFO now or the ETs were really now starting a close encounter with humankind, you know, that the flying saucer was just going to land just next to the White House lawn any minute now.
Wow.
That was like the feeling back in those days, you know. And unfortunately, you know, that didn't come to happen. But nevertheless, I still feel that the Mexican UFO wave was one of the most important activity cycles in the UFO phenomenon of the last, I don't know, 50 years or so.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, especially when you look at it now, we don't seem to get anything major happening nowadays. So it might be one of the last, you know, big gasps of whatever the UFOs are up to. So there's this unquenchable thirst and interest in the UFOs down there. When did it all sort of fall apart, if you will? When did it kind of – sounds maybe it was like a fad, kind of? I'm just kind of trying to wrap my head – like sort of how the X-Files got everybody really hot into UFOs for a while here in the States, and then it kind of faded out. So, like, I guess when did it fade out, and how could you tell? Just, like, did these shows kind of, like – I guess the ratings must have gone down and things changed, right?
Well, like you said, you know, people start to lose interest eventually, you know. I mean, how many blurry videos of blobs, you know, of light can you see before you started to say, okay, so what's next, you know?
Yeah.
Show me something more interesting, right? And I guess that by 1996, maybe with the arrival of the chupacabras is when things started to go down, you know, in terms of public interest. Because I also have to point out that those days were very, very important in terms of social uprising and social disturbance here in this country. You know, there were a lot of important political events happening all around, you know, like, for example, the Zapatista insurrection that happened, I think, in 1994 or 95, I'm not sure. But that was something that I guess people were starting to pay more attention to those kind of things.
Yeah, and didn't the economy, take a big nosedive toward the late 90s?
Sorry?
Didn't the economy down in Mexico take a big nosedive, like, in the late 90s?
Yeah, you're correct. By the start of the presidency of Ernesto Zedillo, who was, you know, right along Carlos Salinas de Gortari, you know, the Mexican economy had a big crisis. And I think they call it the tequila effect or something. Here in Mexico, they call it the December error. But what happened is that, you know, many banks, you know, declared themselves in bankrupt, and they asked for the government to go and save them, right?
Yeah.
So much akin to what happened in the United States and elsewhere, you know, in 2008,
right.
The banks and said, you know, I have to save us. Same thing happened here. And yeah, I guess you're right. You know, when people are worrying about their income and their jobs, they're less interested in what's happening, you know, with UFOs and with things that are seeping around or up in the sky.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, what's the, because people have asked me this, you know, with all this Roswell slide stuff, and I'm glad we got you on the show, because we're going to really try, folks, not to spend too much time on the Roswell slides. But what I tried to what I couldn't really properly explain to people, because I didn't quite understand it, is, I guess, and I want you to explain it, because you'll know, you talked about sort of like in the early 90s, how Jaime Maussan was this up-and-coming journalist, easily an enterprising journalist, let's say, because he kind of figured out the hook of these UFO videos and that it got people all worked up. That was 20 years ago. So I guess what's the, in Mexico, what's the perspective of Jaime Maussan, you know, to the average person and everything? I presume he's kind of like a celebrity, but then, you know, because you hear people in ufology talk about it, you know, and they spin it in a whole bunch of different ways. You know what I mean? Some people will say he's like the Dan Rather of Mexico, and other people will say like that he's a tabloid TV host in Mexico. So it's like I have no idea really sort of what his public standing is down there. So I guess what do people think about him? Like, is there an American equivalent to him that people might be able to sort of draw that comparison? What's his the state of Jaime Maussan in the public eye down there here in 2015?
That's an interesting question, because even before he became so focused on the UFO phenomenon, you know, he was involved in the Mexican version of the 60 Minutes TV program, you know, so he was making a lot of journalist exposés on things like the environment and the ozone layer and all that. So he always had the rap of being like a very, like you said, a tabloid-like type of sensationalistic type of journalist, even though it has to be said, you know, the things that he was talking about 20, 25 years ago, like, for example, global warming on the ozone layer, you know, now have become part of the mainstream, right? So in a way, he was vindicated of sorts. But now, after, like you said, he harnessed the energy of the Mexican UFO wave of the 1990s with these videos he produced called Luces en el Cielo, Lights in the Sky, you know, which to my mind are still a very important historical document. I think that probably the best exposition or documentary about that particular time in history in Mexico. He then produced a TV program called Tercer Milenio, the Third Millennium, which are still running in Mexican television. And he has also, you know, making all sorts of appearances and on other different TV shows along these years. But the problem is that he has slowly but surely lost a lot of credibility he once enjoyed, you know, in the early 90s, you know. I mean, because he supported a lot of cases which eventually turned out to be, you know, either hoaxes or dubious, you know. There was this guy whose name I don't recall right now. It is this American doctor. Well, he called himself doctor, you know.
Oh, Dr. Jonathan Reed.
Exactly, Jonathan Reed, you know, the guy who's claimed to have, you know, like an alien on his freezer, you know, and that the alien had used some kind of weapon to transmogrify his bulldog, you know, and like putting him from the inside out or something like that.
Yeah, some crazy story,
and,
yeah.
Exactly, and now Sam was in some of the programs with most ratings in Mexico, in Mexico television, like showing this guy, you know, and showing his story and claiming that the guy was the real deal. And unfortunately, to this day, you know, Maussan is still supporting the story behind the guy, you know, even though that, you know, you ask to an American ufologist and nine out of 10 will tell you that Jonathan Reed was a charlatan.
Right, right.
So those are the things that which have really hindered his public figure, you know, in a part of the Mexican populace. But it has to be said, you know, the guy still has a lot of support from the Mexican public. You know, that was easily confirmed when I went to the Be Witness event on May the 5th. You know, I mean, the guy didn't actually manage to fill the whole of the National Auditorium, which is has a full capacity of 10,000 seats, but I guess the guy came close because there were about between 6,000 and 7,000 people,
wow,
you know, who paid money to watch this event, you know. So that says something. I'm not sure if the people in the United States will be able to replicate that kind of success, you know. I mean, go to,
oh, no way,
like, I don't know. Yeah,
they'll be lucky to get 600 at an event.
Exactly, you know, so that's something, you know, there's something about the guy is still, and it has to be said, you know, the guy is very charismatic, you know, the guy has this aura, you know, he's very passionate about it. I mean, I know that after what happened on the Native event, most people are attacking him and saying that he did it all for the money, you know, that who knows what much money he managed to make out of this event. He actually says that he lost money, but I honestly think that he did it not because of monetary reasons. You know, I think that he genuinely believed that the Roswell slides were something important, or maybe he just wanted to embed himself in the Roswell mythology. Who knows? Or maybe he wanted to go down in the history books, you know, with being the only guy who managed to fill the National Auditorium with a UFO event. But the thing is that the guy is not really, he's not doing it just for the money. Otherwise, he would have bailed out of the UFO scene a long time ago. That's what I feel, anyway.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah. Well, it's an interesting, I guess we will get into the Roswell slides, because 6,000 people, that's amazing. How much, the logistics of it, I guess, like how long were they promoting this thing down there, and how much did it cost even to get in to check it out?
Well, he started promoting it since early February. I think that February the 5th, which is a national holiday here in Mexico, he held a press conference, and in which he announced that he was going to organize this event.
Okay, so like 3 months.
Yeah, and he then launched a very aggressive personal campaign to promote the event. He went to several radio stations, you know, and probably several TV programs, TV shows, in order to promote the event. And the price of the ticket varied greatly according to where you were, you know, to how close you were to the stage. I think myself and my cousin Fernando, who I asked him to come with me because he's also very interested in UFOs, he's been for a long time. I think we paid about $50, $50 US in pesos, like 750 pesos or something for our tickets, which were in the balcony section, you know.
Oh wow.
Well, fairly close to the stage, you know, not as close that you wouldn't be able to watch the faces of, you know, Richard Dolan or all the people who were, you know, invited. But
yeah,
and the cheapest the tickets, I think they were like 400 pesos, which will be like $30 or less. You know, I think it has.
It has to do with like where you're sitting and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean.
Although those were the seats that were left field. But in any case, you could say that the guy did his best to accommodate people of all sorts of economic background. You know, even people who wouldn't be able to pay as much for a ticket. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it wasn't really that expensive. Otherwise, I wouldn't have attended in the first place.
That makes sense. You sound like me again. Yeah. Yeah. What was the mood like? I guess I find it hard to believe that all these people were sort of like UFO true believers. So I kind of figure that maybe it was a diverse mix of people who like were intrigued by this and maybe just people sort of out for entertainment. Maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to get sort of in the minds of this crowd. And what was their reaction to the event? You know, were they impressed with this slide, or were they dismayed when it was all said and done? I'm not taking into account what we find out later. I just mean like that night.
Well, perhaps if we take into account the sort of things we've been discussing earlier about the Mexican UFO wave, you know, maybe that explains why so many people attended in the first place, because there were people of all sorts of ages. I mean, even my cousin Fernando, you know, was kind of surprised and say, "Oh, look how many old ladies are here in the theater," you know. Man, and I said, "Yeah, right," you know. And I started to wonder if the demographics of this event kind of equated the things that started to happen in American UFO conventions, you know, when people say that only senior citizens, you know, people who have pensions, you know, have enough time to spend, you know, are the ones who bother to attend one of these conferences instead of, you know, just finding the UFO stuff on the web. But there were also people of my age, you know, between 30 and 50 years old, you know. So maybe those people have had a lifetime interest in UFOs, maybe triggered by a personal sighting, you know. You know, maybe someone saw a UFO 30 years ago, something that really had a huge impact on them, you know, and because of that, they started to follow Maussan, and then they heard about this, you know, and they said, you know, I mean, and after he hyped it so much, you know, he said, you know, these are, you know, the event that will go down in history, because for the first time, we have proof, you know, that aliens have visited this planet, you know, and you hear something like that, you will say, "Oh my God," you know.
Yeah, that's maybe. That's pretty cut and dry. You can't really, So, what was the reaction when they saw the slide?
The reaction was, I guess, positive. You know, I
positive,
think that, there was definitely not kind of like a whistling of people saying, "This is bull crap, you know, this is phony," you know,
right,
nothing of that, you know, you know, even if someone was, you know, not really buying it, I don't think they would have dare, you know, to expose themselves, you know, like,
yeah.
Imagine if you're like in a football stadium, you know, and you are, you know, rooting for the other, for the other team, you know, right in the middle of a whole of hooligans, you know, you're going to keep your mouth shut,
right. You're ready to get out to the car to say, like, oh shit, that slide was awful. What are we doing here? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I even asked my cousin, you know, did you buy this? You know, did you think this is the real thing? And I think he was really interested. I mean, when I went with him, you know, I didn't expose him to all the things that I had already searched with regards to the leaked images of the slides.
Right.
That had appeared, you know, almost like a month after Mao Zedong had announced the big event, you know, and greatly enraged him, you know. I mean, he was really pissed off about it, you know. And I tried to keep that to myself because I really wanted to see an honest reaction from him. So by gauging his reaction, I guess that most people became convinced by the evidence, or quote unquote evidence, that he presented. Also, given the fact that he also had all these supposed academicians and very, you know, credited scientists who were, you know, telling the people with all sorts of anatomical, you know, very technical terms, you know, how this body was definitely not concordant with normal human anatomy and all that, you know. So those kind of things were coupled with the energy of true belief. Maybe that's why people were, you know, so willing to conceive, you know, and accept what they presented, as little of what they presented, you know, as the real deal.
Now, what I found striking coming out of the whole thing was, you know, obviously it was the crazy reaction from ufology, where they just crushed the story within like 48 hours, which was awesome. But it was like, I said to Greg Bishop, it felt like it was when ufology finally jumped the shark, because it's like, even none of the American press even covered this. You know, even the most even the most ridiculous tabloid sort of websites and stuff like that, nobody touched this story. I think the only papers that touched it were a couple of UK tabloids.
Yeah, the Negro and the like.
Yeah. And so to me, it was like, well, clearly this is beyond the veracity of the slides and everything. It's like clear now that this subject is just beyond not being taken seriously by the media, you know, here.
Let me ask you this, you know, because we even have had this discussion on a previous occasion, you know. Remember that time when I kind of like jibed you and Greg when you have one of these end of the year reviews, you know?
Oh, yes.
And this thing about ufology in China, you know, and I kind of like went after you, you know, with a very stupid comment, like, you know, kind of like sounded like very sort of jingoistic, you know, in a way.
Oh, wait a minute. That was you?
Yeah. Sorry, man.
No. It's all right. Well, let me just finish sort of my thought here, and then you can, because what I may finish saying may change what you want to say. So that's, okay. I don't want to have like a miscommunication. I guess the point, the question that I had wrapped up in all that for you was, I know for a fact the U.S. media didn't cover it. I know that a couple of tabloids in the U.K. covered it. What was the coverage like in Mexico of this? Because it took place in Mexico, and I mean, 6,000 people were there. So clearly there was interest. So I presume that it was covered. So that's sort of the question. Now you can continue with, I don't remember I kind of remember the exchange, but, you know what I mean.
What I was going with that is, before I answer your question, is that, do you think that the fact that the event wasn't held in the United States had a reason, was behind the lack of coverage it managed to have? Despite of how lousy, you know, the evidence actually was.
Right.
You know, even before actually somebody, you know, actually saw the slides themselves.
I'm sure there was definitely a, you know, a bias there. I'd say definitely like a percentage of the reasoning behind the lack of coverage was that it took place outside of America. So, I mean, 30%, 40%, something like that, you know, because I'm sure that's the way it is. But at the same time, it's like, I was surprised because I felt like this was, again, 6,000 people going to see a UFO, an alien slide unveiling. That should be news just on the face of it, whether or not the slide is real or not. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's, to me, it makes no sense. So I don't know. You know, to me, it says that the media is kind of like, oh, these UFO, you know, don't even pay attention to this stuff. They you know, they never deliver anything good. Yeah. But now the more I'm thinking about your point and your question, I think maybe I should raise the percentage even more, though, because, you know, if you look at it, like, it seems like there's one theme that's emerged in over the last few years here in ufology. It's that it's the spectacle of stupidity. You know, stupid spectacles, let's say. And you know, we're talking about really that I am of the big fake congressional hearing they had.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, good point.
And the point is, I guess, like, that's, I guess, the closest equivalent to this, and that got a fair amount of coverage. So
yeah.
You know, but that happened in D.C. So again, I think I think maybe there is sort of a nationalist bias in a way to the whole thing, where they were like, well, it happened in Mexico, so don't even, you know. So it's entirely possible, yeah.
And then again, you know, the fact that it happened in Mexico, but it had to do with a case that is so emblematic with the United States and Roswell. You know, if it was about, you know, a UFO event happening in Mexico that had to do with that case, you know, the UFO case that was, you know, from Latin America, you know, that would have made more sense, you know. But then, you know, talking of something that happened in Paris, France, you know, and you go to China, you know, that's, yeah, kind of like you said. But getting back to your question, it kind of gets a bit of coverage here in the Mexican media, not as much. There may be many reasons for that, you know. We were, after all, right in the middle of a very important and controversial political campaign. You know, there was these elections coming the next month, you know, and there were all sorts of things happening in the Mexican political scene at that time, a lot of scandals and all that. So maybe people were not really paying attention to Maussan and his Sila UFOs because of all of those quote unquote important things happening in the national scene, right?
Yeah, I think another possibility too might just be that it got debunked so quickly that maybe it pulled the rug out from under any subsequent coverage. You know what I mean? Because I think they definitely debunked it within like 48 hours, if not.
Yeah, they
sooner.
Got debunked, but. Maybe only people in the English-speaking countries noticed that it got debunked so quickly.
Right.
You know, because Maussan certainly took his time in actually acknowledging, you know, the debunkers, you know, and going after them, you know. I'm sure that in Mexico, you know, maybe there's still a lot of people who went to the event in May and haven't even heard the fact that the slides were debunked and that the placard was deciphered, you know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just don't know. I would presume, let's say, like, if I went to the event, dude, and it's like now 2 months later and it's not all over the news and everything, I think at that point I'd be like, all right, well, clearly, even if I wasn't connected to what actually happened, you know what I mean? Even if I didn't know what happened, I think at that point I'd be like, well, that must have been bullshit because, you know, there hasn't been some widespread UFO disclosure or anything. Nothing's changed.
Or if you're so caught up with the will to believe, you the fact that it's not being acknowledged by the powers that be reinforces your suspicions that the government don't want to disclose the UFO reality, you know. And the fact that they don't pay attention to it, you know, it clearly shows that it was so important, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I I forgot about that mindset of people, but they're out there. They frighten me.
I mean, Mausam himself, you know, he said, you know, the fact that the placards, the slides have been attacked so much, it's a clear sign that this is the smoking gun that ufology has been looking for all this time, you know. It's always trying to reinforce his mindset, you know, and his worldview, you know, all the things that happened, you know. It's very difficult for a person to actually, you know, look at things from a completely different perspective from the ones you were holding and cherishing so much. You know, it's difficult because you best so much energy and feelings, you know, and emotion, you know, defending your position about some topic, you know, that when someone presents you with very convincing evidence refuting your position, instead of, you know, acknowledging and changing your position, you will, you know, close your eyes, you close your ears, you know, and look for ways to debunk this refuting information.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's one of the problems facing ufology as a whole. Talked about this on the show before, where it's like, you don't get, like the old commercial says, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. It's like, ufology already made it. The UFOs made their first impression, like in the 40s and 50s. And we haven't been able to overcome the mindset that's been ingrained in generations ever since, whether they're pro or anti, you know. It's like people who are ingrained in that, they're just not going to really change their mind. So it's a challenge.
Problem is that the first ufologists, you know, Donald Kehoe, you know, the guys, the Cora Lorenzen and the people behind APRO and all that, even Dr. Hynek at the beginning, you know, they were all supporting and promoting the idea that UFOs were extraterrestrial vehicles. You know, that was that is still the paradigm that ufology is starting to promote, you know?
Yeah.
So, and people that like Jacques Vallée and even our friend Greg Bishop and John Keel, when people were come up with dissenting theories and ideas, you know, things that don't fit in that kind of paradigm, you know, they get shunned out of the field. But the problem is that, you know, it has become so untenable, you know, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that maybe that's the reason why, you know, the mainstream media, you know, see us as a joke.
That's part of it for sure. Yeah. Well, it may be an earned reputation though. They may be right. You know, it's like how can a group of people try to figure something out and be and still not be able to do it? You know what I'm saying? It's like the blame lies obviously with the humans and whatever the thing is, you know, whatever UFOs are.
Definitely.
You know, it's like we're trying to solve a very difficult puzzle, and it's, let's be honest, like the best, we're not working with the best of the best here. You know what I'm saying? Like, the top minds in the world aren't trying to figure this out. So.
Well, maybe they are, but they are not, certainly not doing it inside UFO conventions.
Yeah, they're not telling us what they're coming up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, what Jacques Vallée called the invisible college.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you look at the state of ufology sometimes, and you think maybe they're on the right track, just to kind of bail out at times. Because it's like, if you're not really a promoter, it's hard to really sort of find a niche in a way. You know, it's difficult. But and then the problem too is like you have to find a niche or something. You know what I'm saying? It's a real, it's a combination of like science and entertainment. And and it's like, it seems like right now the entertainment part's like way outweighing the science part. And that's the problem. I remember, I thought when you mentioned the thing about the year in review, I thought you were going to mention this. you tweeted something when Greg and I did one, I think the most recent one or something, but I think he was like, something like, nothing like listening to Bernal whine about ufology on the year in review episode. And it's like, I'm sure there was some whining, but I think you can agree with me, dude. You know, I think we have the right to be cynical about this at this point. I mean,
well,
that's just my take.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, yeah. I mean, take the Roswell flag, for example. You know, mm-hmm. you can see it as like the lowest point in ufology's history, but also you can see the group that came out of it, you know. I mean, the people, the Roswell with the slide research group, you know, which is a group composed of both, people who are pro UFOs and also very, you know, hardcore skeptics, you know,
right.
like Lance Moody and all those guys. They got together for a common goal and they managed to put their minds together and their energy, and they managed to figure this thing out in a matter of hours, you know?
Yeah.
And that I think it's a good thing, you know? If that could be replicated and harnessed to try to solve, or maybe not solve, but try to come up with more information about other UFO cases, you know, that could be a very, very interesting development for ufology.
That's true. That's true. And I got to give you credit, man, because, you know, there's a certain sense of like whimsy about your stuff that I really like a great sense of humor, and also sort of like wonderment that you don't have really the cynical bug as badly as I have. So I that's why I like your stuff a lot too, because it's like you need positivity sometimes.
You know why is that? Because I have made my peace with the fact that I'm never going to solve this phenomenon in my lifetime. That I'm going to go to my grave without ever figuring out what UFOs are. And that's okay, because it, as cliche as it sounds, you know, the journey is a destination. You know, I've sometimes mentioned how ufology has become something of a personal alchemy for me, you know. Alchemy, you know, people have this, you know, kind of cartoon idea that the alchemists were only trying to turn lead into gold, but that was only like a byproduct. You know, the ultimate goal of the great work, as they called it, was to transform the alchemists themselves, you know, to transmutate their earthly matter into divine essence. You know, and in a way, ufology has managed to do that for me. You know, it has been a good endeavor and a hobby, if you want to call it. You know, I don't see why not, because he has managed me has forced me to learn so much, you know, to grow both intellectually and even spiritually. You know, I mean, our common friend Mike Clellan is quite right that if you do this thing right, you know, ufology, you begin by asking yourself about lights in the sky, but you will eventually progress and end up asking about God, you know?
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's not like ufology is my religion, but I can definitely say that ufology has become my path of enlightenment, you know, in a way.
That's deep, man. I like that. That's some profound thinking. You sort of crystallize it in a much better way than I could, but I totally agree with you. You know, I've said before to a guest recently, it was, you know, it's like maybe the whole point of life on Earth is to ask these questions of like why we're here in the mm-hmm. first place. So, you know,
yeah.
and no one's really,
yeah.
no one does that, but you see people in the paranormal do it a lot, because that's sort of, because the paranormal is like right up against the edge of you know, the great mysteries that have been around forever, which is like what happens when you die. Now, what I just said actually made me think of another one of your pieces here, because I apologize, because you say you loathe the word paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about that take, because again, to see a similarity between us, because for a long, long time when I started out, I substituted the word esoteric for paranormal, because I felt like paranormal was too commercialized. But over time, I sort of brought paranormal back into my vernacular just because it was easier and people didn't get it, you know, for a while,
mm-hmm.
The esoteric thing. So I kind of use them now interchangeably more often than not. But I'm interested in your take on that, because you, again, have a more profound sort of idea of you know, why the word paranormal is kind of a misnomer for all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So ill-conceived and so not very – it doesn't fit with this kind of
phenomena. In the first place, because it kind of presupposes that these phenomena and activities like go outside the quote unquote normal laws of nature, you know, like it's kind of violating in a way, you know. And it's a very arrogant attitude because, you know, like we humans still have a lot of things to figure out, you know. How dare we to think that, you know, we know so much already, you know, that we have figured so much out that these things, you know, don't fit with our little model of the universe and therefore they can't exist, you know. Well, maybe that's because our little model of the universe is still a work in progress, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it also presupposes that these events are so rare and only happens, you know, with only to a handful of people, you know, like Stephen Hawking said, you know, only the weirdos and the cranks, you know, are the people who see UFOs, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is that I'm sure you have witnessed this, experienced this firsthand thing, you know. You start to talk to anyone, you know, on a bar or on the street, or maybe like myself when I was going to Paradigm Symposium last year, you know, and I was, you know, facing the immigration agent at the Texas airport, you know, and the guy said, they always ask you, you know, what's the reason for your visit, you know. Mm-hmm. I always tell the truth. I'm going to the Paradigm Symposium. They reply, you know, what's that, you know, and I answer and explain how this is. It's an event about when we talk about UFOs and esoteric things and things that go bump in the night. And the guy, the agent, looked at me in the eyes and said, oh, so you are into that sort of thing. And I was like, yeah, you know, kind of like expecting some kind of sarcastic comment,
yeah,
you know, so kind of jive. And the guy, after 2 seconds, he said, I once saw a UFO near the Mexican border, you know, and started to spend the next 2 minutes or so, you know, describing how he saw this metallic looking things, you know, go zip, you know, back and forth and starting to hover and revolve around each other, you know, and all the while I'm kind of like seeing the people back there in the back, you know, I'm kind of saying, okay, when is this guy going to stamp my passport so I can go and catch my flight, you know?
They're starting to wonder who you are. They're like, I don't know.
yeah.
They're sizing you up.
But the anecdote goes to show that anybody can experience these kinds of events. It's just that our society and our culture is teaching us to disregard them, you know, like as abnormalities, you know, freak, bizarre things that shouldn't really be taken seriously, you know, and even if it happens to you, you know, well, you know, maybe you didn't really see what you saw, you know, maybe you had some kind of hallucination and all that, you know, and people convince themselves, you know, in the end,
yeah,
that especially if it was something really bizarre, you know, only people in the outside, you know, the outsiders are the ones who say, wait a minute, you know, but what about that thing I saw, you know, what does it really mean, you know, and that's why in the end, you know, you end up with ufology filled with all sorts of misfits and outsiders and iconoclasts, you know, and then trying to make these people, you know, get together and agree on something is like harder than herding cats, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not because it's only happening to us. It's because we are the ones who are willing to spend our time, you know, pursuing those events, you know.
Yeah.
In spite of what society is telling us, you know, and because these are the things that go against the grain of our civilization.
Well, I think about sort of the leap that you and I both made from like fan to producer of stuff. And it's like there are times in my life where I wonder if I should have just stayed a fan.
Exactly.
So it's sort of like that. And it's remarkable what you say about this security guard in a sense, because it is, I've had that experience. And it really is kind of like, what's going on over there?
Yeah, my cell phone, sorry.
You're out of control. It's remarkable because, like, when you talk to somebody, when somebody shares their UFO story with you, it really is. I mean, I have grown cynical, and I've gotten to the point where it's kind of like I try to avoid really opening up too much to people, so I don't have to hear a story like of someone's UFO sighting. But but I really should probably change that, because the more I think about it, it's like there is a sense of wonder from the people that really is remarkable. It's like, you know, when you hear that story, that this was something that, like, changed their life, or sort of like, I don't know. It's hard to put my finger on it, but it's like there's a magical element to it almost.
Yeah, and there is this need to share it with someone else, you know?
Mm.
To not keeping it all to yourself, you know? Because it's so profound, you know, like that you actually, like, you feel not confirmation or validation, you know, but like feel to have it being bounced up from another mind, you know. And when people see that you are not going to mock them or going to be overtly skeptical, even though sometimes you need to, you know, when you are going to be open-minded and see that it was meaningful and important to them. And that's also something that we should mention, you know, how the paranormal world has a very important, overtly personal component in everything that happens. You know, I mean, a UFO sighting that has such a particular meaning for you alone, and it was only meant for the person who experienced it. You know, like a synchronicity. You know, you try to explain to someone else, you know, a synchronicity that happened to you, and that it kind of loses its magic when you trying to explain it to a different person, you know, because you can't recreate that sense of wonder that happened, you know, traverse your mind when you, some that happened, you know. But there's this need to share the event, because people need to feel that it's not only happening to themselves, but that not only themselves are interested into this and they're trying to figure out what it all means.
Hmm. It's have you, I guess this is a good sort of direction to go in a way, because you know, people always bug me. They want to know, well, what do you think? But since this is my show, I get to ask that question. So as someone who is an observer of all this, you know, what do you think is going on? I mean, it's nearly, I mean, you said you'd go to your grave not really knowing what it is, but I mean, do you have any, you know, what's your best guess? What's your suspicion?
My best guess is that the UFO phenomenon hints to a reality that is bigger and more complex than we can possibly fathom. And they also seems to originate from a reality from which our own reality is only a tiny subset. So in other words, you know, maybe the best way I could say it is that UFOs are real, we who are imaginary.
Mm, I like that. I like that. That makes sense. Yeah, as crazy as it sounds, it makes it makes sense, yeah. Well, there's a lot to that in a way. Because it's like you talked about, sort of like this arrogance of the human race. It's there is a real problem there where it's like we can't unstick ourselves from the center of the universe, you know?
Yeah.
And it's gonna take something that does that, that'll unlock maybe the ability to understand all this or figure it out, you know? So it's I think that's a difficult part of it all. You know, we're beholden to our own sort of like selfish desire to keep us at the center of the universe. So,
and it's a paradox, because at the same time, you know, modern science has always tried to beat us, you know, out of a supposed encumbered place in the universe. You know, it's always trying to belittle us and saying, you know, okay, so the Earth is not really the center of the universe. It's just a planet in the solar system, you know.
Yeah.
And then, oh, well, but the solar system is just, you know, a tiny fraction of a galaxy, which is also, you know, a tiny fraction of the universe. And it's always trying to say, you know, see, you know, you and your life are utterly meaningless. You know, this is something that our friend, common friend Alex Akiris, you know, is always fighting with the arch skeptics, and because these guys, you know, they're obviously coming from a very materialistic and very, you know, let's say it, an atheist worldview, you know. My way of thinking it is that the fact that we humans are aware of our own irrelevance in the universe is the very reason that gives us our relevance.
Yeah.
You know, you see what I'm saying?
I see exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, we are irrelevant, but at the same time, we're not irrelevant because, like Carl Sagan says, we are the way in which the universe is experiencing itself from a subjective point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It makes sense. It makes perfect sense. It's, it is, yeah. Well, there's this, you know, I'm continually, again, cynical about sort of just the scientific world and how they handle all this stuff. You know, it just makes me very agitated because I don't understand. Well, I do understand it sort of like on a psychological level, but it's very frustrating. Or it's like, can we just all be on the same page here? Can we just take an honest look at this without all the agendas? You know, I think there's like a group of people in sort of ufology that are kind of coming together with that kind of attitude and being sort of more just generally inquisitive rather than, you know, pushing sort of an agenda of having a solution or something like that. So it seems like we're doing our part, but but the other side, there's no one really. Well, there's guys like Tyler Kochjohn and a few other folks that are sort of are crossing the line to the middle with us, but it's increasingly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, like our friend Greg Bischoff is so fond to say, and I happen to agree with him, you know, the answer to ufology is probably going to come from outside ufology. You know, and that's not such a terrible thing to ponder, you know. I mean, you know, so what? You know, so the answers will probably come from outside the field, you know, and maybe from people who approach the mystery and the phenomenon from a completely left side view, you know. But then again, you know, well, you know, we've been spending the last 60 years or so, you know, collecting files in a cabinet, you know, like our friend Nick Redfern is so fond of criticizing, you know.
Exactly.
A complete cabinet full of files. You know, how many files do we need before we think, okay, I think we have enough. Now we start to parse this thing out and see what we can come up with, you know? And maybe we have to admit that is not the approach.
Well, I mean, that's what got me excited about the Jacques Vallée stuff that was coming out last year, that he was going to try and put together this database. I thought that was like the best story of the year. And you know, it really was kind of underreported, I thought, and sort of like these year in review type things, because it was like, here's someone trying something. Here's someone, you know, who's come up with a pretty good idea that who's coming up with the good ideas to figure this out? They're few and far between. So it's, you know, you got to applaud it when it happens, but.
Yeah,
I don't.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else can be done, because it's like the collection of files doesn't seem to work, and you know the reports. How many reports do you need? It goes back to that whole thing, and then the problem I think with ufology, and I preface all this sort of ufology talk with American ufology, because I do want to know you if there is a. I'm sure there's like a Mexican ufology scene and what that's like. So before I get into that, I just want to sort of put a bow on this. It's just that now I lost my train of thought because I started thinking about Mexican ufology. So, but the American
you started to thinking of sombrero like UFOs.
Well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that American ufology is just it just doesn't seem to be. You know, that's it. There's the train just arrived. It's like American ufology seems to have made this leap from like, okay, we've collected enough cases. Now we want the answer without sort of, it's like, it doesn't work that way. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like no one seems to have informed these exopolitics folks that it's like, and you know what it is? I honestly feel like it, there's a personal thing. Like you talk about the old ladies at the event down there on May 5th. It's like, I almost wonder if it's sort of like people that have been in this for so long where they're like, we deserve this. You owe us this. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, no one owes you anything just because you had an interest in this for 40 years or whatever, or spent your life chasing after this for like 30 something years or 40 something or 50 something years. Like no one owes you anything, unfortunately. And it's like, it's the job of the UFO researchers to figure this out. It's not up to us just to get a whole bunch of stuff and then be like, we have a bunch of stuff, tell us what it means. It's like, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and the journey itself, you know, it's the thing that prepares you, you know, for managing to be able to carry on with the burden of the knowledge, you know. I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is like, for example, in any kind of like, mythical story, you know, like George Campbell and you think with the hero, you know, like if you go to Luke Skywalker in the first Star Wars movie and say, oh, by the way, Darth Vader is your father, you know, yeah. Oh, here's the lightsaber, you know, go and say, no, it doesn't work that way, you know, you really have to do the leg work, you know. I think that it's the same with ufology, it's the same with all kind of things that is meaningful in life, you know, I mean. Just trying to extend your hand and say, give me the thing that I know that you have and that I feel that I deserve. It's not really going to work. I think that, you know, I'm very critical of someone like Steve Greer, you know, that I think that I don't like his take on the phenomenon and his approach. But that said, I kind of like his idea of saying, you know, screw the governments of the world, you know, we are going to have a direct experience with the phenomenon all by ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? To me, that's more valid and more interesting than the idea of waiting outside the doors of Congress or the White House gate, you know, expecting that these people who have, if you think that is the case, they have lied about what they know about the UFO phenomenon, that all of a sudden they're going to come around and say, oh yeah, you're right, you know, I guess you guys have mature enough. I guess you guys can handle the truth. Yeah, yeah. Here are all the files, you know, that we've been compiling, you know,
right.
About this phenomenon all these years. Here you go. You know, what if Bishop says, you know, what if these guys have also, you know, a whole cellar or a whole warehouse full of files of cases, and they still don't know what the hell is going on?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Because that's what's happening to me, Tim. I mean, I've been studying UFOs for the last, I don't know, 30, 35 years, you know, I'm 41 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I can truly say this, you know, that This is the only thing I can state with any veracity, that the more I know about UFOs, the less I understand them.
Exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth. That's what I was going to say, too. It's like the more you try to understand this stuff and the deeper you get into researching it, the more perplexing it is. You know, it's like when I first got into this, I was just sure it was the aliens. You know, I was like, oh, it's clearly aliens. Then the more I get into it, I'm like, I don't think it's aliens at all now.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't even, yeah, it's a difficult, it's an extremely difficult topic, and it's, you know, the research of it has been mismanaged for so long that it's,
yeah,
that it's really, that's the part that's like perplexing.
Yeah.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.